Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
It's wonderful to see so many of us all here together, and we really appreciate your coming. So we're continuing on with our conversation about the Scripture of Great Wisdom. I'm beginning to see that my role here is to give you the technical details of the Scripture, and then what we all get to do in the discussion is bring the heart into it. So I'm hoping that we can have a little more discussion time tonight and have a chance to actually do that. We stopped with, I was explaining at the end of our last talk, or for most of our last talk, what shunyata is, what the word that usually gets translated as emptiness is. So we went through a lot of that, and we ended at a point where I was saying that one of the implications of this teaching of shunyata or emptiness is that life is a moving, changing flow and not static or fixed. And what that means is that we can become Buddha because we're not stuck where we are. And Nagarjuna said, because of emptiness, all things are possible, which I think is a very beautiful way of expressing it. So this teaching of emptiness opens up this arena of boundless possibility to us. Now, also embedded in this teaching of emptiness is this teaching that nothing is separate. Reality is undivided and indivisible. And I love those words to express it. And those words are really another way of saying reality is non-dual, which is, to me, a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. And duality is when we're bouncing the opposites up against each other, opposing things to each other. But non-duality expresses the connection of everything and our oneness with everything. Everything's oneness with us. Okay? So what happens then? So I want to put into the mix here another sense of what emptiness is pointing to. When we name things, when we conceptualize things, when we have concepts about things, our thinking process, the way that we tend to reify things or to create a thing, okay, that's different ways of saying the same thing, or divide things up into this and that's, we're actually standing outside this prajna wisdom, which is emptiness, okay? So that's part of why the thinking mind and conceptualizing become the boogeyman in Buddhism. So I'll just give you a little example of this. The notion here is that when we conceptualize something, we miss-see it. So we're missing reality as it is, and part of what we're not seeing is its emptiness or its non-self-existence. One way to think about that is we all know what a chair is, and it's very handy to know what a chair is. And I can say to Annie, build me a chair, and she knows what I want, more or less. And chairs are a very separate object, you know. But we don't have a word that means chair and floor. And what if we wanted to point to the unity of chair and floor? So I'm trying to sort of say here that we separate objects out, and that supports our seeing them as separate entities, and that's very helpful in daily life. But it doesn't support our seeing the connectedness between things. If a chair is suspended in the air, it's of no use as a chair. But when it's sitting on the floor, it's very useful. But we don't describe chair and floor together. We describe them separately. Now, some of you look puzzled. And if you look puzzled, if you are puzzled, don't worry about that too much. That's one of my ways of conceptualizing this for myself. Here's another thought. This morning I had two pancakes for breakfast, and I put marmalade on one and syrup on the other and yogurt on top. And I ate the pancake with the syrup first, and it was yummy. And then I took a bite of the one with marmalade, and I thought, ooh, this is really bitter. The syrup is bitter. And I had forgotten it had marmalade on it. So I'm thinking, oh, this is weird, bitter syrup, forgetting I'd just eaten very nice syrup. And then I remembered, oh, this is marmalade. And suddenly it tasted really good because I knew it was marmalade. Excuse me. Nothing had changed, right? But my way of thinking about it, my way of looking at it had shifted. So this thing I had construed as syrup, when I realized it was marmalade, it was all fine. So what I'm trying to point to with an example like that is when we're conceptualizing about things, we're not seeing the whole truth of them. And that means that we can misunderstand them. Well, part of what it means is that we're creating a world with our mind and our way of thinking that's not the actual world. And it means that we can misconstrue things so that we can actually cause harm through misunderstanding them. Okay? Another way to think of this is if I put this mug right here, everybody in this room sees that mug differently. And we look at it and we can see the front part that we can see. Some of us can see a handle, some of us can't. And we can see part of the back part of the mug and some strange colored something inside it. But what if, I mean, we know it's a mug, so we fill in the rest, right? We don't actually see what we're seeing. We see our concept of a mug or a cup, and we fill in the rest. And each of us has a different perspective on it. With a mug, that's pretty harmless. But when it comes to human beings, it can have wider ramifications. Okay, so I'll just kind of toss those thoughts out as something for us to consider and to explore. But I think the point here is that what Shunyata is trying to point us towards is letting go of our dividing the universe up into individual separate objects that aren't connected, and remembering that they are connected, and that the universe actually functions as one organism, can I say that? As one being. So nothing is actually as we conceive it. And this is unbounded, liberated existence. I love that phrase, unbounded, liberated existence. I don't know if I invented it or if it came from somewhere else. But when we stop dividing things up, when we recognize the limitations of our conceptualization, we are then living within this unboundedness, this liberated life. This is the freedom or the liberation that Buddhism points us towards, that nirvana is. So, it's most of the time ego or attachment to self that prevents us from seeing clearly and prevents us from dropping our conceptualizations. And this points us, so that's one thing to look out for, is ego and the way that it asserts itself. And this points us towards the practice of our meditation, which is a radical practice of letting go. Letting go of our concepts or our views or our ideas about things that we create through our words and our thinking processes and our conceptualizations. Sitting down and just seeing what's there. And over and over and over again, letting go. Okay? Without any attachment to our views. Letting go of every single thing that arises. And that's how meditation is the practice of emptiness or shunyata. Okay, so that, and this scripture I said in the beginning is really about our meditation practice and our practice in daily life. And we'll get to that part in a minute. Okay, so the practice of emptiness is the practice of not clinging. We were chanting the dedication of merit at our offering ceremony with Reverend Master Daishin before the holidays. And there's a line in there, because our hearts are one, this world of pain, sorry, it makes me cry every time. Because our hearts are one, this world of pain turns into paradise. And as we were singing that night, I thought of the scripture of great wisdom and the way that it points to this oneness of our hearts And that's what turns this world of pain into paradise. So our suffering becomes nirvana when we recognize that our hearts are one and live from that place. Okay, so that brings us, at least for now, to the end of these opening lines in our translation comparison. When one with deepest wisdom of the heart that is beyond discriminative thought, the Holy Lord, great Kanseon Bosatsu, knew that the skandhas five were, as they are, in their self-nature, void, unstained, and pure. Okay, and so I want to move on to the next section. O Shariputra, form is only pure, pure is all form. There is then nothing more than this. For what is form is pure, and what is pure is form. The same is also true of all sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness. And I think you all understand that Reverend Master Jiu is translating emptiness or shunyata as pure. Most other people translate it as emptiness. And I want to just read a couple of other of the translations on your sheet. I think I'll just read the first two, because the first one says, Shariputra, form is not different from emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Okay? And the second one is exactly like that, except it says form is precisely emptiness, and emptiness is precisely form. And I think this introduces a nuance that's important that I'm hoping we'll see as we go along. Okay, so first of all, let me just say this begins with O Shariputra. So if you read Akamura and that longer version of the scripture that he has in there, you'll remember that we've got this big congregation on Vulture's Peak, and the Buddha enters into very deep meditation. And Kanseon or Avalokiteshvara picks up on this very deep meditation of the Buddha's and is addressing the congregation from that place of meditation, hearing the Buddha's teaching through the meditation and voicing it. And she is responding to this question from Shariputra, who asks, and Shariputra is the Buddha's chief disciple in wisdom, Prajna. And he is asking, how does one actually practice this wisdom? And Avalokiteshvara Kanseon is answering his question. So this is the first time Shariputra shows up in our version, but that's why it says, O Shariputra, here, because Kanseon's actually addressing him as this disciple who has this profound understanding of wisdom. Okay? So this next bit is considered by many to be the crux of the sutra, of the scripture. And what it's saying is that form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And that's also true of all the five skandhas. Okay? So, and this is where I get, this is, for me, the hardest part of the scripture. Because describing emptiness as we have over the last time and a half, it makes sense to me that form is emptiness. But then to say that emptiness is form is like, wait a minute. I don't think I can go there. But I think it's really important that what this is saying is that the two are absolutely congruent. That there's no... I want to say they completely permeate each other, but that's like saying there's two different things that come together and permeate each other like water in a sponge. And that's not right, because they're actually just one thing. They're the same thing. And part of the way I understand this is if the nature of all things is emptiness, which is what this scripture ends up saying over and over again, you know, it's not just human beings that are empty, but the skandhas that make them up. And then it goes on to say everything else is empty too. And given that that's the nature of how things are, Everything's empty. So, and then, so anything that exists is emptiness expressing itself. I'm sorry, I can't quite put this in words, but if the nature of everything is emptiness, then everything is emptiness. So that's where the emptiness is form comes into it for me. Now, the way that Akamura talks about this, I think, is profoundly helpful. And to summarize what he says, he draws this distinction between absolute and relative truth. And this is the teaching of the two truths. It's usually capitalized, the two truths, which is a fundamental teaching in Buddhism. You have either run across it in other places or will if you do any reading. And that's that there is absolute truth and there is relative truth. And emptiness is absolute truth or universal truth or the truth that's beyond, you know. Sorry? Go ahead, what did you say?
This world.
This world. Beyond the truth of this cup. You know what I was about to say. Beyond the truth of the particulars of our life. What Akamura says is that when we understand what emptiness is, we've realized absolute truth. But you can't stay there. You have to do something. And to me, this takes a very literal form. You're sitting in meditation and everything's empty. You know, nothing's, you're not clinging to anything. You're letting go of everything, right? The perfect meditator. And and you think, oh, this is bliss. I'm never getting up. I'm going to just do this forever. Well, what happens? I mean, what happens is your mind changes and you don't stop. You do start clinging or, you know, attachment returns or you get distracted. But the other thing that happens is you have to pee. And so you have to do something about it, right? Or let's say you can get past that thing, but you are starving or very thirsty. You know, eventually, I mean, I'm being really sort of simple-minded here, but eventually you have to get up and do something about something. You can't just sit there on your cushion forever unless you're some really deeply realized yogi. And there are stories. But so I think that Akamura is really brilliant in the way he shows how in effect what he's saying is that form is the expression of emptiness. Form is emptiness manifesting itself in a way that we can see, you know, and in a way that exists in our life. So those manifestations are the relative truth. Our having to pee is relative truth, and we have to take care of that. As he says, we have to do something with our lives. So we get up and do something with our lives. We have to make choices. And so we make choices. So that's relative truth. And there's this relationship between absolute truth and relative truth where they're constantly, in a sense, morphing into each other. So emptiness becomes form and form becomes emptiness. As we move through the recognition that things are empty of any kind of self-existent separateness, but they're full of whatever it is we're going to do next, whatever next step we're going to take. And then as we take that next step, you know, we go through our day, and then maybe in the evening we return to meditation. Or as we go through our day, we recognize, you know, we now and then return our minds to the sense of emptiness. We let go. We let go of clinging. We can actually make a practice of saying to ourselves, you know, whatever this is that's arising is empty. And remind ourselves, that doesn't make it go away, that doesn't change it, it doesn't make it less painful, but it does shift our focus and it brings in this sense of the absolute truth in relation to the particulars of our daily life. So I wanted to illustrate this with a Mobius strip. I did this once before. In 2011, we had a Women in Buddhism retreat, and I used this as a way to illustrate the relationship between wisdom and compassion. And I don't know how many of you know what a Mobius strip is, but it's a thing where you take a sheet of paper, a strip of paper, different on both sides, and you do a half turn, and that's the critical part. It has to be a half turn, and you join the ends. I didn't do that right. There's no turns in that. Okay, there we go. You join the ends. This is something, you know, that they show to little kids because little kids are fascinated by this sort of thing. Then you take a pencil, and I'm going to use my finger, and you start drawing on one side. So right now I'm on the side of the paper with the pattern, right? And if I keep going, I'm going to end up on the side of the paper that's white. Mm-hmm. And I haven't lifted my finger from the paper, right? And then I keep going, and I end up back on the side of the paper that's patterned. And that's, to me, that's a really wonderful illustration of emptiness morphing into the absolute morphing into the particular. The emptiness morphing into the details of our daily lives. And it also holds for wisdom and compassion. And to a certain extent, you could take what Akamura is saying about absolute and relative emptiness and our daily life and translate that into wisdom and compassion. So wisdom, prajna, is the emptiness, and compassion is bringing that emptiness down into the heart and acting in daily life from the heart in a way that helps beings. So in that sense, compassion becomes not exactly synonymous with, but compassion is like the relative daily life part, and wisdom is the absolute truth part. So,
may I add a footnote to it?
I'm sorry?
May I add a footnote to it? When you move from this card into the white, left becomes right and right becomes left. And the other thing is, this is finite, space-wise, but unbounded.
There you go. All right. So we've gotten rid of the opposites and we're into the unbounded in one fell swoop. Thank you, Milan. Okay, let me think about where I was. Oh, so I just wanted, I guess I'm just trying to say that the relationship between wisdom and compassion is like the relationship between emptiness and daily life. And we say that compassion without wisdom can cause harm because the wisdom isn't there. Wisdom without compassion can be very dry and intellectual and conceptual and hard, without heart, in effect, without heart. And the scripture of great wisdom falls on the side of wisdom and emptiness, but Kanzan's there to remind us that this is really about compassion. So her presence there keeps bringing us back to that. Okay? So give me a second here while I catch up with myself. I'm not sure that solves the issue of form and emptiness are exactly each other, but I think it points a way towards us seeing how that is. Form is an expression of emptiness, and emptiness is the true nature of form. Okay? So our practice of letting go is seeing reality from both of these perspectives, the form and the emptiness perspectives, without being attached to either. Okay, so, and I think we come up against this over and over again, where we're holding two things in our hands that seem very different. When we stop attaching or clinging, that separation disappears, and they begin to come together and become each other. Okay? And the scripture is saying here, what is form is pure, and what is pure is form. The same is also true of all sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness. So this is true of all five skandhas. In other words, of everything that comprises what we are. Okay. So form gets emphasized because it's first. But it's just as true of everything else. We could say that form illuminates emptiness and emptiness illuminates form. That would be a way of throwing some light, pardon the pun, on this teaching. But again, it's not quite right because it's not a matter of one illuminating the other. It's a matter of them being the same thing. Okay? And holding both of these moment by moment at the same time is really the doorway to the end of suffering. And how that is so is something I could think we could talk about more as we go on. I've been thinking about inadequacy partly because I have this really intense sense of my own inadequacy. It's very heavily conditioned into me. And I was wondering if this might be an illustration of this relationship. I'm not sure this will work, but just very briefly, inadequacy is a delusion. It's a major delusion, right? I mean, we're all Buddha nature. We're all who we are. We're all fine and whole, just as we are. How could we not be? How could anything not be? It is what it is. The chair isn't defective because it's not a table, you know? Really? So the delusion, when I'm, you know, basking in my inadequacy, I'm forgetting about emptiness, right? But so if I can remember emptiness, the inadequacy can begin to dissolve. However, the inadequacy is so conditioned in me, it's a kind of reality that I have to pay attention to partly because it causes a great deal of harm to both myself and others. Because when you act from inadequacy, you don't offer the world all that you are. And lots of other reasons, but I don't want to spend all night on this. So I have to deal with the inadequacy. So in Akamura's terms, the inadequacy is the everyday reality that's there that I have to do something about, even though the inadequacy from the point of emptiness is a delusion. Okay? So the emptiness and the daily life feed into each other. And this isn't just with making soup for dinner. It's with these much more difficult things that we face. When somebody dies and we're deeply grieving, well, yeah, it's empty, but so what? The grief is there, you know? And to say that to somebody would be very hard-hearted and unfeeling and cold. So those are my attempts to explain this relationship between form and emptiness and how one is the other, okay? And I think that this only makes sense within the experience of lack of separation or the undividedness of reality. When we get out of the whole subject-object thing, you know, our subject-object perspective, which is so strongly enculturated into us as Westerners, is the foundation for separateness. You know, there's subject and object itself and other. We're not connected. When we can let go of that opposition and sit within the undividedness or the lack of separation, that's when we can have this experience of the unity of form and emptiness. We enter into non-duality in effect. And I want to stop talking in 1 minute, and I, as usual, have way more to say. And I'm going to shunt my last remarks to the next talk. But I do want to say something about there are experiences that people have, and we've touched on them, that point the way towards this understanding of emptiness. In classical Buddhism, it's often described, in Japanese, for example, in Japan, it's described as the bottom falls out of the lacquer bucket. In early Buddhism, the flame of the lamp went out. I see it. Oh, you know, if I were to take that piece of paper I was describing, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's piece of paper, that where does the paper end? It contains the whole universe. Well, so we can talk about the paper that way. If I were to take a lighter and burn this paper up right here, and it dissolved into the air and there was nothing left, that might be a doorway into an experience of emptiness. The monks who build sand mandalas, and then after days and days of hard work, this meticulous, and then wipe them out. Emptiness. John's example about his group therapy sessions, where there's this sense of harmony and open-heartedness, where there's no division between people, and there's just this openness. Roger last week was talking about the peace and contentment that you feel after going through rapids in a boat. Did I get that right? That's right, but you two know. Okay, so there are, you know, examples from our own experience. And I think this is something that is important, that we could talk about at quite great length, and we would see that we all have these kinds of experiences, and that these aren't a place where we can live, but they point us towards a knowing of a truth, and that truth is the truth of emptiness. So I'm going to stop there.